This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 6th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 263. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, former Whitecaps and National Women's Team soccer coach Bob Berarda sent to jail for 16 months for sexual assault against four players. My guest is Kira McCormick, who blew the whistle on Berarda in 2019 and got the ball rolling on a new wave of athlete activism in Canadian sport. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is John Horgan's premiership ending with a whimper? Horgan was sworn in as the 36th Premier of British Columbia on July 18th, 2017. David Eby will succeed him on November 18th, 2022. Horgan was supposed to make his farewell speech in the legislature on November 3rd, but he was absent due to unspecified illness. Earlier in the week, he hosted a Star Trek-themed Halloween party and also was the guest of honor at a cocktail party farewell. The last time a BC premier retired was in 1986 when Social Credit's Bill Bennett chose not to run again. Otherwise, they've been defeated or left in scandal. NDP leader John Horgan battled through throat cancer earlier this year and faced caucus upheaval over his support for the LNG industry after his ill-advised decision to try to renew the Royal BC Museum for close to $1 billion. Horgan led his party to its biggest majority in the 2020 snap election. He leaves amid the ongoing pandemic, opioid overdose crisis, and a shortage of doctors, nurses, and paramedics. The tragedy of the June 2021 heat dome lingers. 619 people died when the government failed to warn British Columbians of the record heat wave. The No Context BC Gov Twitter account, however, carried this following tribute to the populist premier. He had the gift of the gab, but also had a knack for putting his foot in his mouth sometimes.
I'm looking for a sign. Are you the sign?
Premier John Horgan.
There's been a lot of trains coming down my track over the past 5 years. The Twitter dome and the Insta stuff. I very much regret that it landed with a thud.
Come on, man.
I don't know if you want to zoom in on that. That's my telephone screen.
Do some history, man.
You do not need 48 eggs. I'm sure that all of us know to never read the comment section. Now, when I say that, I can almost hear eyes glazing over.
It's a global pandemic, dude. The honorable member from way the heck over there. Come on, man.
I play Scrabble. I have Spotify. I check my heart rate. I know what the weather's going to be like in Prince Rupert. Anyone who wants to look at my telephone is happy to come to my office and look anytime they want to.
Have gone up and gone down and gone up and gone down.
No one came to me and said, holy cow.
Oh, now I'm rambling. I'm chewing up the clock.
Oh, look at this. Intruder alerts. Intruder alerts. And I have email, I have text messages, and I have a telephone and a host of other things that I don't even know what they are. I don't know who you are. Get a hobby. Find something else to do with your time. In the faraway island of Salamisand, Yertle the turtle was king of the ponds.
Why don't you go in the bathroom and talk to yourself in there?
If you were woke, you'd know that pro ref is lit.
Any advice for whoever turns out to be your successor?
Well,
always duck early when you see the brick coming at you. The power of salmon is in all of us. So, we all good?
That was the tribute to outgoing Premier John Horgan from the No Context BC Gov Twitter account. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. Later this month, Canada's men's soccer team will return to the World Cup for the first time since 1986. On November 2nd, however, the former coach of the National Junior Women's Team and former coach of the Whitecaps Women's Team was sentenced to 16 months of jail, 4 months of house arrest, 4 months under curfew, and 3 years of probation. Bob Berarda pleaded guilty last February to sexually assaulting 4 teenage players between 1988 and 2008. Provincial Court Judge Deanne Gaffar said Berarda breached the players' trust and exploited the power imbalance. He was the gatekeeper to their future in the game. The judge said that Berarda made them suffer emotionally and physically. My guest is the whistleblower. In February 2019, Kira McCormick wrote a blog piece when she discovered that Berarda was coaching teenage girls. It's called A Horrific Canadian Soccer Story, the story no one wants to listen to, but everyone needs to hear. It led to international media attention, protests at Whitecaps games, a police investigation, and eventually charges for Berarda in late 2020. North Vancouver's McCormick played in the NCAA, W League, and leagues in Europe and Australia. She was also a member of Ireland's national team. I started by asking Kira McCormick if the jail time for Bob Berarda fits the crime.
I mean, I don't think anybody, obviously, like the four victims for sure, I'm not sure how they feel, obviously, but I know there's a lot of people that weren't a part of the criminal trial that's lives were, you know, very much affected and altered by Berarda, that I'll never get their soccer careers back, that I'll never get their happy innocence of sport back. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the positive is that the truth came out and that he suffered consequences. But I just, I mean, I think at the end of the day, 16 months for all the carnage he caused, I don't think, but to be honest, I don't think there's ever going to be a sentence that'll, you know, truly, again, you know, give justice, if you want to say, and, you know, be proper punishment from what was taken away from people.
This was a real roller coaster because for the better part of a year, we didn't know when this would actually get to a point where there would either be a trial or a plea. It was cancellation after cancellation of court hearing, postponement, and not much in the way of clarity at all or transparency from the Crown about what really was happening until it got into court back in February of this year, and he did make that guilty plea.
Yeah, there's been, I'd say, like emotional points at, you know, throughout the whole, you know, last 4 years since I wrote the blog. But yeah, finding out that he had pled guilty in February, I think it just kind of, you know, again, there's, I don't think I personally really realized the sort of stress that I was under with the situation, because I think obviously, like, I knew the truth of what had happened, but you, again, you never know with like high-powered lawyers and, you know, people being vindictive, and obviously, I'm sure, yeah, I mean, so I think just, like, once he pled guilty, it was, like, leaving out a breath of fresh air in the sense of kind of, you know, a relief that this actually, yeah, just, again, in the court system was being validated for the seriousness that we knew that it was the whole time, and again, also, obviously, just to know that the victims wouldn't have to be put through a trial was also like a positive. So yeah, I would say that was kind of like the peak emotional moment of the, you know, since I published the blog.
Outside of the court, there were different reports by different parties. You know, the Whitecaps commissioned their own report at the end of 2019 by a sport and law consultancy from Toronto. There was the Major League Soccer report, hired a different law firm in Toronto. Those two reports have been described by many people as really whitewashes that really didn't get to the point and didn't put anyone under any accountability. There was a different report. Richard McLaren, one of the world's top sports law professors from University of Western Ontario, best known for his investigations of the Russian state-sponsored doping at Sochi 2014, he did a report that definitely was hard-hitting that came out at the end of July that did point fingers at the Canadian Soccer Association and at the Whitecaps for what they did do and what they didn't do. Has there been proper accountability yet, or are we still waiting for answers?
To be honest, like, what I think was great about the McLaren report and juxtaposing it with Sportlaw and Ruben Tomlinson's report and just how poor those two reports were, I think, you know, I think now we're at a point that the public is very aware as to, like, what these, you know, just again, how these processes work and how these organizations hire essentially PR firms to write reports that really don't mean anything. And I think, yeah, with the McLaren report, I think that that obviously got to the meat of what happened and painted a timeline, painted a picture of who was involved. I think there has been accountability more than I think people could probably hope to expect in these situations. I think in the past, I think Sportlaw and Ruben Tomlinson have showed just how these situations are whitewashed with these bogus reports. And I think the McLaren report and just how strongly it outlined what happened and who was at the scene of the crime. I think from an accountability standpoint, I think there's a document now that tells the truth as to what happened. I think there's people like lower level people, you could say, you know, the executives like Rachel Lewis and Greg Anderson, who were reported to have been the, you know, two of the four suspended executives. You know, they obviously are no longer with the organization and no longer overseeing young people in sport, which I think is a positive based off of the evidence of what's been presented and their actions in these situations. But then, you know, obviously the Leonard Doozies are still a part of things with the Whitecaps, and the higher level people that were on the Canada Soccer executive that were named in the McLaren report, you know, none of those people have faced any accountability in all this. So I think, I think at the end of the day, the truth has been exposed. And I think that that obviously it's taken 14 years to get here, but I think, yeah, I think it's the scab of all of this is starting to be ripped off, and the wound, if you want to call it, is being exposed. And from an accountability perspective, I think we're much further along than most, you know, situations. So I think to focus on the positive, I do think we're on the road to accountability. I don't think we're at the final point yet, but I think we're much further along than probably anybody could have imagined we'd have been in 2019 when I wrote my blog.
You mentioned Bob Leonarduzzi, who was demoted from the presidency, but he's still with the organization, an organization that's owned by Greg Kerfoot, who has not answered any questions from reporters. I've tried over the last several years. He's someone who has owned the franchise since it was in a lower league, the USL, back in 2002. So he's been owner for about 20 years and done no media interviews. Over on the Canadian Soccer Association side, two people that were there in 2008 when Bob Berardi was employed, Victor Montagliani was on the board. Peter Montopoli was general secretary. So you had a director and the top staffer there in 2008. Today, Victor Montagliani is the head of CONCACAF, and he's the vice president of FIFA. Peter Montopoli is the chief operating officer for the Canadian division of the 2026 World Cup. He's overseeing the games that are going to be in Toronto and Vancouver, heavily subsidized by taxpayers, close to the tune of $500 million. And these men, well, the key questions are, what do they know and when do they know it? And if they knew something, why didn't they do something? Those questions need to be answered, especially now since they have so much power on the road to the biggest sporting event to be held in Canada since the 2010 Winter Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, Greg Kerfoot was someone that I sent a letter in 2011 to Dan Leonarduzzi, Rachel Lewis, and Greg Kerfoot, asking them, amongst other questions, but, like, you know, they knew what Bob Berardi had been fired for, and why was he still, why hadn't they said anything, and they knew he was back coaching teenagers. So, I mean, from my own hand and my own email, I have proof that Greg Kerfoot was definitely aware. But I think, again, you know, talking about owners of clubs, like you look down with the Portland Thorns, with Merritt Paulson down south, and a similar situation of, again, you know, knowingly allowing someone that had been fired for sexual misconduct to quietly go back and coach. So I think, I mean, again, you have an MLS, you know, the Real Salt Lake owner forced to sell because of racism, but, you know, sexual violence and cover-up is allowed apparently, and not a thought of at the same level. So I think societally, we have a ways to go to start really taking this issue seriously and making owners have consequences for these sorts of actions. And I think in terms of, you know, Peter Montopoli and Victor Montagliani, I think the McLaren report clearly put them at the scene of the crime, so to speak. And absolutely, neither one of them have, you know, there's really like been nothing. But I think that's a part of what all of this is exposing, is just like we have a real lack of mechanisms to hold people accountable. And at the end of the day, these entities are taxpayer funded. Absolutely. So, you know, it's not like they're, you could argue that private, you know, organizations can do whatever they want, but obviously national sport organizations are different. And obviously with events such as the FIFA, the World Cup coming in here, you know, it is again, you know, propped up financially by taxpayers. So you think in theory that those people would have to answer, and that this is something, you know, it's not just like hearsay anymore. Like, we now have a convicted sex offender with an offense from 2008 when he was fired from Canada Soccer and the Whitecaps. And so, I don't think anybody can argue anymore the, you know, seriousness of all of this and just the egregious, you know, behavior that allowed him to go back on a soccer field for 11 years. So, yeah. So from that standpoint, I think absolutely. Yeah. I think that a Greg Kerfoot, Peter Montopoli, Victor Montagliani, like, it's not acceptable the way that they behaved throughout this. It's not acceptable what they put us through, allowing him to go back quietly onto soccer fields and to be front and center after he'd been let go for sexual misconduct and the carnage that he had put, you know, Barda had put so many of us through that even weren't involved criminally in the trial. So I think these are just like bigger ethical issues that as a society, like, we need to start looking a lot more closely at. And yeah, like I said, I think we are moving in the right direction. I do still think we have a ways to go.
I want you to go back to February 2019 and remember what was going through your mind just as you're finishing the blog piece, a horrific Canadian soccer story, the story no one wants to listen to, but everyone needs to hear. The headline really says a lot, says everything. What was going through your mind as you're finishing that and when you pushed the button? Think back to then and compare it with the way you feel this week after the sentencing of Bob Rutter.
I sent a tweet out yesterday just as I was reflecting on everything. And I think, you know, it's just wild, really, when you sit back and think about the world we were living in back then, that literally, you know, Barada's fired from arguably the top position in terms of from a gatekeeping perspective of women's soccer in this country. And obviously he knew what he had done. And then to 3 months later be like that, feels that invincible to go. And it's, you know, again, not like he went to coaches U8 team in Prince George and nobody noticed. I mean, he was coaching at Coastal when he got arrested, or sorry, not when he got arrested, when the blog came out, he was at, you know, front and center at a BC PSL club coaching. He had won the U17 Canada Soccer National Championship the year before. Like, so, I mean, I think, yeah, like that was part of the harm of all of it, is like, how are we existing in a society and in a soccer community that, like, everybody knew some version of the story that was around in 2008, because you don't lose a job 6 weeks before a World Cup and there's no story behind it, you know? So, but again, the point of it also is that those Canada Soccer and those people that you mentioned prior, like, those people allowed everybody else to say, oh, well, he didn't do anything, you know? So I think for me, I was in a very low place at that point. I don't think I really appreciated that we had gaslighting is the word that I've learned in the last few years, that I didn't know what that was at the time, but that's what it was. And it was highly traumatic what we were going through. And obviously, again, we didn't have the language to really know why we couldn't move on from it, and just how serious we knew the situation was, and just that we were living within a community that thought that was okay, you know? And so, I mean, yeah. So I would say it was from a place of like rock bottom and being terrified, but just knowing that whatever I was afraid of couldn't be worse than how I was feeling, and just how I didn't feel like I could move forward in my life, you know, knowing that he was still on a field coaching teenage girls and that everybody was just watching it happen and doing nothing. So yeah, versus where I am now, I mean, this is obviously like beyond a best case scenario in terms of how this is all, you know, played out to this point. And obviously it was a massive, massive risk that I took, and that other people, you know, that came out after my blog, that they, like, we all took big risks in terms of coming forward, and we didn't know what would happen at that point. So I think, you know, I feel an immense amount of pride, and, you know, for, I guess, what I did and what everybody else did as well. Like, I think it was a massive collective effort to just shift the narrative that, like, it's not okay. It's not okay to stay silent. It's not okay to, you know, put success in sports ahead of taking care of people and doing the right thing. So I think it is. It's about shifting the narrative moving forward. And it's about saying, you know, what's okay and what's not okay, and drawing that line. And so I think that that's the biggest thing that I think has sort of changed in what came out of coming forward in 2019.
Also look back at what this also did for other sports. So you really got the ball rolling, and your influence was felt in other sports. Other athletes found their voice, stood together as one away from the field of play to ask for accountability, demand accountability about the people that were running their sports, whether it's the coaches or the administrators or the boards. We've seen it this year. Bobsleigh Canada skeleton, gymnasts, boxers, Hockey Canada is the big one. One way, shape, or form, there have been athletes or people elsewhere inside the sports that have been demanding reforms there so that players can be safer, and of course so that money can be properly shepherded and these organizations be properly governed. We're seeing a shift in Canadian sports. It's not over yet by a long shot, but this has been a watershed year. And from where I sit, I don't think this would have happened in 2022 with all these other sports, if not for the risk that you took back in February 2019.
Well, that means a lot. I mean, I think it's just, you know, I think for so long as athletes, we've sort of been dictated to, and I think, you know, we've been sort of told it's a privilege to be a part of things. We've had to adhere to high standards to be a part of the environments, but yet there's been no accountability on the other side. So I mean, obviously there was people that came before me in terms of you know, Jen Simard was a skier that was the first whistleblower with the Alpine Canada case before our case, you know, so I mean, again, like I think it's been like a massive collective effort. And I mean, if writing the blog, you know, like I said, it was kind of, I really hope that nobody's ever in that state of mind that I was in when I wrote the blog, because honestly, it was like hurling myself off of a building and like not knowing what was going to be at the bottom. And obviously there was a lot of trauma that like took me to the place to do that. But I think, yeah, I think collectively athletes are finding their voice. I think sports doesn't exist without us. And I think even collectively behind the scenes as athletes across different sports, like we're all helping each other and we're in touch. And you know, again, it's going to take a massive collective effort across all sports. And I think, again, it's happening, you know, seeing now that like the government is paying attention and there is so many different people that are like at work and speaking up. But yeah, I mean, like, again, that's a really nice thing to say, but I do think there's people that even came before I did. And I mean, I know even like I was very, I don't know, I feel like watching the Larry Nassar case and the victim impact statements was a very big moment for me in terms of realizing and hearing the stories and recognizing our situation and a lot of the same characteristics amongst them. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a really, really amazing, powerful thing to be within this massive wave of athletes speaking up. And again, I'm just really proud of everybody that's like taking a stand on this stuff. And I really think collectively, I mean, I just think we have to change the structure. I think athletes have to have a voice in the system. I just, that's what it boils down to. We've been dictated to, we've been made feel small, but at the end of the day, sports doesn't exist without us. So yeah, it does feel like together we're a part of, you know, a sort of a tidal wave of change, if you want to call it. So it's I mean, again, just mentally, my whole state is just miles, miles, miles different than it was before. And I think just continuing to move towards a place that what we went through is just a distant memory of the past, because now there's so many protections in place. Like, that's my goal and dream moving forward from here.
What next for you? I mean, are you, for instance, lending your voice to the campaign to try to get a Canadian Women's Professional League, for instance? Is that something that you're involved with? And, you know, what next for you as you go forward from this?
I'm involved in a few things. I'm looking at just sort of made a partnership through my company to start to help a pathway to Europe for Canadian female players, because again, right now the reality is that there's really nowhere for people to go. So that's something that I'm working on. And I'm working on a few different initiatives, but yeah, all sort of to do with, increasing opportunities for female soccer players, and then also just increasing athlete voice and ensuring athlete safety. So those are all things that I'm looking to be a part of and put my time into moving forward.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. That's Kira McCormick. Almost 4 years ago was her blog, A Horrific Canadian Soccer Story, the story no one wants to listen to, but everyone needs to hear. Thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That was my guest, Kira McCormick, former professional soccer player. Go to kiramccormick.com for more information. That's CIARAMCCORMACK.com. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China co-chair conferred Taiwan's Grand Medal of Diplomacy. Reinhard Budakofer recognized for remarkable contributions for bolstering Taiwan-EU relations. Taiwan's foreign minister said Budakofer consistently protested China's authoritarian expansion and voiced support for Taiwan's democracy. He also has called on the EU to review its One China policy. In addition, Budakofer issued a statement to show solidarity with Lithuania when it faced economic coercion from China. When the Hong Kong national security law was implemented, the German lawmaker launched IPAC to direct attention to Beijing's domestic oppression. In Kyoto news, major China motor show postponed as zero COVID policy kept. The Guangzhou International Automobile Exhibition is a large-scale event at which major global automakers launch new models. More than 200 million citizens in 28 cities across China have come under some form of lockdown as of October 24th, according to a unit of Nomura Holdings, Inc. The latest is the Foxconn iPhone factory in Zhengzhou, a plant that counts 300,000 workers. In the Hong Kong Free Press, eviction of historic Hong Kong Mahjong tile shop halted as government considers construction plans. Biu Ki Mahjong, one of the city's last remaining shops producing and selling artisan game tiles, may stay in its decades-old store in Jordan for now, pending discussion with the building's department, the shop said on Facebook. In 2014, Mahjong tile making was listed as one of 480 items in the first intangible cultural heritage list, which identifies crafts, practices, and customs that should be safeguarded in Hong Kong.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Salem Statesman Journal, Oregon is done with daylight saving time. While a state can opt out of daylight saving time and be on standard time year-round, federal law does not allow the reverse despite widespread interest. Earlier this year, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed bipartisan legislation to abolish clock changes and make daylight saving time permanent beginning in 2023. But in June 2022, the U.S. House failed to pass the bill, which is now stalled and scheduled to expire in December. Let the debate resume in March 2023. In the Spokane Statesman Review, members of egregious multi-state fentanyl distribution ring sentenced to collective decades in federal prison. 20-year sentences to Hunter Romali, 19, and Caleb Carr, 23, and a 16-year sentence to a third member of the group that called themselves the Fetty Bros, Matthew Gudino Pena, 22. They each pleaded guilty to conspiracy to distribute 400 grams or more of fentanyl. O'Malley and Carr trafficked the illicit pills and other drugs to Washington and Idaho, including supplying the drugs that have been linked to the overdose death in May 2021 of a 15-year-old high school freshman in Coeur d'Alene. In Czech news, ice cream thefts costing grocers thousands weekly in Greater Victoria. Ice cream is flying out the door, according to Bowen Osoko, spokesperson for the Victoria Police Department, but Osoko said the thefts are drug-related. People who are struggling with addiction, and in particular methamphetamine, are looking for something to keep them conscious, Osoko said.
That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand
alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
parents who adopt children in need. It's Adoption and Permanency Awareness Month in British Columbia.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 6th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 6th of November in 2002, Chinese police arrested writer Zhang Lijun after his open letters on the internet called for democratic reform in China? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. And please take a moment to wear a poppy on November 11th to remember those who gave their lives for Canada and to pray for peace.
Until next week.